I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Many may believe it's the judge who holds the most power in the courtroom, but much of the time, it's the prosecutors who are the key players in the outcome of a case. Today, how district attorneys have reshaped America's criminal justice system. We'll learn how the exercise of power has affected mass incarceration and convicted the innocent, and how reform-minded prosecutors are being voted into office to reverse these trends. Then, a look at two Supreme Court decisions that shaped American life and culture. We want to know what impact you experienced from Brown versus Board of Education and Roe versus Wade. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. In recent years, the way to get ahead in the world of politics was to become a prosecutor. Once on the job, a prosecutor could go full out to protect the public with a tough-on-crime platform geared to win admirers from the left and right. After all, who could argue with a full-throated call to put bad people in prison? Well, Emily Bazelon points out that prosecutors-turned-politicians have reshaped American criminal justice, and maybe not for the better. The result has been too many people in prison and the convictions of innocent people. Now states across the country are pushing away from the lock-em-up-and-throw-away-the-key approach. Emily Bazelon discusses all this in her new book, Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily Bazelon is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and a Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law at Yale Law School. She's also a co-host of the Slate Political Gabfest. That's a weekly podcast. She just spoke in town at an event in support of the ACLU of Missouri. Emily, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on the air.
Now, we've had some pretty prominent prosecutors turned politicians. I'm thinking of Rudy Giuliani. I'm thinking of John Kerry. Is it a mistake to elect our prosecutors?
No, not necessarily. I think the question has been that mostly in the past, to use the district attorney or state attorney's office as a stepping stone to higher office, people have run as tough on crime. It's sort of the assumption was, well, you can't lose by trying to lock up more people and being tougher. And so that, you know, is related to why we have so many people in jail and prison these days.
Well, why do we elect them to begin with?
Why do we elect prosecutors? That's a great question. We're actually the only country in the world that elects local and state prosecutors. We started doing that in the 19th century because some states wanted a directly democratically accountable prosecutor. They had the idea that if they connected this person to the local voters, that they would be more responsive to local concerns. But it's a really unusual model around the world.
If you could wave your magic wand, would you change the system?
You know, that's such a good question. I think that right now we are seeing DA's offices become more reflective of the communities that are impacted by the justice system. So there's a wave going on right now, a kind of movement bubbling up in a lot of American cities and counties to elect prosecutors who are promising to reduce incarceration. And honestly, that wave reflects a bipartisan increasing support for the idea that the system is just like ballooned to be too big and it's ruining a lot of people's lives. That said, there are states, five states, that don't elect prosecutors. One of them, New Jersey, has a centralized state attorney's office. So like everyone who is in office as a prosecutor works in a centralized system. And that model has worked well. I think it's less political. New Jersey passed criminal justice reform recently, and it's been quite effective there. So that's a really interesting alternative.
You say in this book, one of your main points is that the prosecutor, not the judge, is the key player in the criminal justice system. Why is that?
Well, when you go back to the late 70s, you see crime rising. You see politicians start to capitalize on making voters afraid of crime. And then you see this wave of increases in sentencing laws pass, and a lot of them have to do with mandatory sentences. So you're saying if you commit a robbery, you have to get at least 3 years in prison. once you have a mandatory minimum sentence, you've actually shifted a lot of power from a judge to a prosecutor, because the sentence is baked into the charge and the plea bargain. And those are the parts of the criminal procedure that prosecutors control, right? Judges don't decide what charges to bring, and they don't decide what plea deals to argue. We didn't talk about this at the time. We didn't say, oh, we're passing these sentencing laws to take power away from judges. We talked about eliminating discretion from the system. But you can't actually do that. It's like toothpaste, like it's going to come out. And so instead, what we really did was we gave more power to prosecutors.
How do judges feel about this?
They don't like it.
Yeah.
Federal judges in particular have had their hands tied by a law Congress passed in the 90s that made it much harder for them to grant appeals in criminal cases. But state judges, too, are sometimes saying to prosecutors, hey, I don't want to send this person to jail. Can you drop the charges? If the prosecutor says no, then the judge can't do anything about that. And, you know, the reason this matters is that judges are the people in the system whose job is to be the impartial, neutral referee.
Mm-hmm.
Prosecutors don't have that job, right? Prosecutors are supposed to be ministers of justice, but they're also supposed to win convictions. So it's a fundamentally different dynamic when they're the ones with the power.
So the power is with the prosecutors. That's your conviction here.
Yes, that is my conviction. And, you know, in talking to prosecutors across the country, in the last few years, I think a lot of prosecutors have owned up to that. I hear them acknowledging that they have a lot of responsibility for the way the system works. And then, as I was mentioning earlier, there are some prosecutors who are interested in changing the system. So it's not that they're losing their power or giving up their power, but they're harnessing their power in a different way because they answer to a different set of voters.
I was going to say, why is the pendulum swinging back? Is it because of prosecutors recognizing some issues with what's occurred in recent years? Or is it because of state legislatures who are saying, we can't afford to build all these prisons?
The state legislators have not really been taking the lead. They kind of are nibbling around the edges of mass incarceration in some states or not doing anything about it at all. I think what you're seeing is local community groups related to the Black Lives Matter movement, also a strong kind of fiscal conservative distress about how much the system costs. So you see this kind of bipartisan effort to say, you know what, if we can change who sits in the DA's office, we can change a lot about how the justice system works. And that local prosecutor, his power or her power is our power because we, the local voters, choose that person. So that awareness and sort of harnessing the power of prosecutors to make them answer to different set of voters, I think that's what we're seeing here.
It is something of a miracle, it seems to me, in our current political climate that there is bipartisan support for this idea of ending mass incarceration. We haven't seen bipartisan support on very much of anything lately.
You're so right about that. And it's one of the really fascinating things about this area. And it made it very exciting for me to be working on my book because things were changing as I was trying to tell the story. I had a new story to tell. You know, one comparison that I think is apt here is marriage equality. So, you know, 20 years ago, a lot of people were skeptical that gay people had a right to get married. And I think they hadn't thought about it that much. And once that issue kind of surfaced and more people thought about, okay, well, people want to get married, why not? Then you see the poll numbers shift rapidly in favor of marriage equality. I think similarly, a lot of people hadn't given much thought to the criminal justice system, right? Like most of us don't want to get tangled up in it. We don't go to criminal court. Lots of the people, you know, I'm writing for you, the reader, who's not standing there every day seeing what I see. And so I think for a lot of people, it's like once you focus on this and you think of the harms that are being done and the way in which the system is still like this huge machine pumping out punishment, even though crime has really fallen, you think, wait a second, what are we doing here?
We're talking about the power of prosecutors and how they've transformed American criminal justice. Our guest is Emily Bazelon. Her new book, Charged, The New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. If you want to join our conversation, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Emily, if you would, tell us about one of these new reform-minded prosecutors. And I should point out that one of the prosecutors prosecutors I've seen you cite in interviews is our own Mark Dupree, who's the Wyandotte County District Attorney, who was elected back in 2016. He's from the Kansas side of the state line here. But maybe cite one of them and tell us, describe what one of them is trying to do in his or her jurisdiction there.
Yeah, well, let me tell you a little bit more about Mark Dupree.
Yeah, sure.
So he runs for office. He has a background as a criminal defense attorney. He's also a minister. He's a super friendly, charismatic guy. And he becomes the first African-American elected district attorney in the state of Kansas. Comes in 2016 with a reform platform in a couple of ways. So one thing was that he inherited an office that had some problems in the past with wrongful convictions. And so he promised to set up a unit to review past cases to make sure that innocent people aren't in prison, right? That's like something nobody wants. So he was trying to address that. And he also has been trying to change the practices for turning over evidence. So, you know, this is a recognition that it's the cops who gather the evidence in a case and the prosecutors who receive it. And defendants don't necessarily know what the state has that could help the defendant prove their innocence until the very last minute before a trial. So Mark Dupree was interested in opening up what's called discovery, the process of providing evidence to the defense. And if you hand it over earlier, if you give people a better sense earlier of what the state has gathered, it can help them show that they didn't commit a crime. And that is a really important aspect of the system that a lot of these reform-minded prosecutors are interested in addressing. It's like they're making the law more accessible and more fair on their own.
It's interesting to me that even in a place like Wyandotte County or anywhere, that rank-and-file voters are beginning to pick up on the need for change, too, because Mark Dupree had a tough race for election to Wyandotte County DA. And are you surprised by that awareness of voters?
You know, I think that voters are learning a lot about this issue. So a couple of years ago, the ACLU did a poll in Massachusetts and found that something like 40% of voters didn't know that they had the right to elect their local DA. It just wasn't on their radar, right? Mm-hmm. I think because of this movement and more races where there's someone in office and then a challenger, it's like lifting up the whole relevance of this office. And I think ideally, given that we do elect prosecutors in this country, we would think of the DA as like someone like the mayor, someone who we care about this race. This person reflects our values and we just understand how much power they exercise so that we can make sure as voters that this person is doing the job the way we want it done.
The power of prosecutors. That's our topic today. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Welcome.
Hi, great show. Two issues. One is that I have testified as a friend of the court on several occasions. What happens is the judge comes in and asks if there's any possible mitigating factors involved with the client. It's not about guilt or innocence, but he wants to understand the situation better. And he does that in part because if there's legitimate mitigating factors, he can use that to modify the sentencing guidelines. The sentencing guidelines have been a total travesty for this company. It's cost us hundreds of billions of dollars, and there are innocent people there or nonviolent people there that neither the prosecutor nor the judge want to see in prison. That's one. The second thing is electing prosecutors is just insanity because that pushes them to have as many convictions as possible and to sensationalize as many as possible. So people are getting less of a fair shake, and you got the push to actually put people in prison who, in fact, may be contrafactually innocent. Prison system itself admits that 11% of all incarcerated are contrafactually innocent. So
right.
We got real issues we need to fix, and it sounds like we're getting on top of it finally. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Chris, thank you. Chris's point, Emily, that mandatory minimums have cost this country hundreds of billions of dollars. Do you buy that argument?
Well, yes. I mean, it is true that locking up more people for longer periods of time costs a lot of money. And, you know, increasingly, there's more evidence about what it really takes to prevent crime. And sure, while someone's locked up, they're not going to be committing a crime on the outside. Like, that's obvious, right? And there are certain amounts of crime that are deterred by the threat of a prison sentence. But we are way, way past what's necessary to deter crime in the way we punish people. And, you know, there's also an argument that it's become counterproductive because jail and prison make people more likely to commit crimes when they get out. And almost everybody gets out. So I think it's really important to pay attention to that body of evidence when we're thinking about how we want to spend our resources.
Back to some phone calls here. Herman from Leawood. Herman, you're on Up to Date with Emily Bazelon. Good morning.
Yes, I'm enjoying what you're saying. I tuned in a bit late, but I just wanted to say that it's my observation that I call them eager beaver attorneys that are trying to get to higher office, that are prosecutors, go for a high percentage and sometimes I think use, I don't know, a kind of bogus evidence or whatever to get convictions. And I think it borders on what gets to be very unfair, especially for poorer people who can't afford a real good attorney.
Yeah. Herman, thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You know, Emily, in your book, Charged, you talk about a couple of cases to drive home your points here. One involved a young woman named Nora Jackson, if I'm saying her name right, Memphis resident who was 18 when she was charged with the murder of her mother. And this came despite a lack of physical evidence or even eyewitness testimony. Tell us about Nora Jackson.
Yeah, this story really, which I tell in my book, relates to your caller's concerns. So Nora Jackson was 18 when her mother was stabbed to death brutally in the middle of the night. This was a middle-class neighborhood in Memphis. Lots of pressure to solve this kind of crime because it scares people. There was no obvious suspect, lots of DNA evidence, which went away for testing. And while the DNA was at the crime lab, suspicion started swirling around Nora, largely because she'd been out all night the night her mom was killed. She was out at a party, and she sort of seemed to the prosecutor, I think, like a little bit of a wild child. So Nora's charged with her mother's murder, and then the DNA evidence came back, and it actually excluded her from the crime scene. And there were profiles of two other unknown suspects, but nobody looked for them. The prosecutor had already made this decision and stuck with charging and trying Nora for this murder. Nora was convicted, but then her conviction was overturned by the Tennessee Supreme Court because of the prosecutor's misconduct. And so I think what you see here is exactly the kind of problem of a prosecutor overreaching and committing misconduct in the course of convicting someone.
You say this prosecutor was all about keeping up his tough-on-crime reputation. That's who this guy, I think it was a guy, that's what it was all about.
Yeah, absolutely. And this prosecutor is actually a woman. Her name's Amy Weirich. And she went from being the child prosecutor to the elected DA in Memphis. And so, you know, your caller earlier was talking about this problem of prosecutors doing everything they can to win big convictions in order to get elected. Well, this is that kind of story.
You also write about the plight of Kevin, and that's a pseudonym, a teenager arrested on a gun charge in Brooklyn. This is how you open your book. What happened to Kevin?
Yeah, so Kevin was charged with possession of a gun, which in New York can be a serious violent felony. Not the case, I don't think, in Kansas or Missouri, but a crime that in New York it's taken really seriously. And so he faced these serious charges, but he was prosecuted in Brooklyn, which has a district attorney named Eric Gonzalez, who's part of this reform movement. And so Kevin was given a second chance. He was allowed into what's called a diversion program. Mm-hmm. He was working with a social worker over the course of the year. And so I followed him to see what would happen to someone who, you know, is the kind of kid that we're often frightened of, you know, a young, poor Black kid from the city with a gun. He did well in this program. And so I wanted to tell that story, too, to offer a kind of alternative.
He lived by a certain code of honor in his neighborhood. So when he was arrested on the gun charge, he admitted that the gun was his. I mean, explain that to us.
Yeah, this happened a lot in my reporting where there was a gun somewhere, like a group of people, of young men, had access to a gun. In this case, it was an apartment. the police saw the owner of the gun flash it on social media the day before. That was why they came to the apartment to find it. But in this sort of hectic moment where the cops were at the door, Kevin was the one who picked up the gun. He was trying to help his friend. He knew his friend had a record. He thought, okay, well, if I'm the one with the gun, I won't get as much trouble. And he had the kind of crazy idea of flushing it down the toilet, and which didn't work, obviously. I tell this story because I want to show, you know, first of all, the people who get caught for having illegal guns are not necessarily the people who are the shooters or even the owners of those guns. And also, this kind of code that you're talking about of loyalty among friends can operate in a way that really backfires against a particular kid, even though having a gun is something that in other contexts, you know, the NRA, the gun lobby might celebrate.
So as we wrap up this conversation, is there any doubt in your mind that the pendulum now is swinging back and swinging back forcefully?
It is swinging back. We are seeing incarceration go down in most of the metropolitan areas and big cities in the country. I'm not sure how forceful it is yet because the levels of reducing jail and prison are still pretty slow. Like it will take us at our current rate 75 years to get to half. And I think a lot of people feel like that's too long and more dramatic steps need to be taken. So I think we've started down this path and it's really up to American voters to demand that politicians go further faster.
You know, before I say goodbye to you, I wonder if we can shift gears just a little bit here, because you've done some work for The New York Times Magazine on Senator Kamala Harris, the presidential candidate. And you wrestled with this question about whether she was a progressive prosecutor or not. And your conclusion was maybe she really wasn't. Tell us about what you learned about her, because she's really emerged as one of the Democrats' more prominent candidates here.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting way in which Harris's record as a prosecutor had been a real strength for her, right? She goes from being the DA in San Francisco to the attorney general for the state. She's one of two Black women across the country who won statewide office when she was elected. And so for her, the kind of strength of this role was a political asset. Now that she's running for the Democratic nomination for president, people are looking back and thinking, wait a second, were you a progressive? What were the things that you did that maybe don't really reflect where the criminal justice conversation has gotten to since then? And so Harris has ended up really threading a needle on this question.
Emily Bazelon, her new book, Charged, the New Movement to Transform American Prosecution and End Mass Incarceration. Emily, great conversation. Thanks for enlightening us here today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Time for a break. When we come back here, we'll ask the question, where were you when Brown versus Board of Education came down, as well as Roe versus Wade? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, FEMA says everyone should carry flood insurance, whether you live right near a river or on top of a hill. Hear why at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, her latest album blends timeless music with a contemporary perspective. We'll speak with Kansas City native Kelly Hunt. That's on KCUR's Up-to-Date tomorrow. Well, there was a time not all that long ago when the law of this land permitted separate but equal education. In other words, before the Brown versus Board of Education ruling came along in 1954, racially segregated public schools were regarded as legal as long as the quality of education for both blacks and whites was equal. Problem was, black and white schools weren't equal, not even close. That landmark ruling was important for another reason. It marked the first crack in the legal architecture of American race law. So our question today, where were you when Brown v. Board came down? How did you react to it? And did you realize the ruling was as pivotal as it turned out to be? Our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Our guest is Dan Wedel of the UMKC Law School. He serves as Director of Academic Support. And Dan, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
No question that Brown versus Board ranks as one of the all-time monumental court rulings. Any question about that?
No, it really changed everything with regard to race and the law. when it came down, even though it only affected schools at the time, public schools, it ultimately led to the 1964 Civil Rights Act 10 years later, which applied laws against racial discrimination to non-state entities. So it really transformed everything. Its effect on the segregation of schools has waned somewhat, that many of them have resegregated, but not by law.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Was the ruling recognized as a landmark when it was issued?
Yes. In fact,
No one doubted this was a big deal.
No. The court understood it. I think the public understood it. And part of it was because it was going to so fundamentally change education across the nation, and the resistance was going to be huge. And so Earl Warren was able to take a court that was actually divided on the issue and corral it into a 9-0 decision.
9-0. There's been some news coverage of late, Dan, that some judicial nominees are refusing to affirm the Brown ruling. Is there some degree of, you know, reconsideration going on out there when it comes to this ruling?
Well, not that I'm aware of. Nothing very serious. I think it's basically a bulletproof ruling. I don't see it being overturned.
Any sense of what the present day argument might be against it, and why some judicial nominees might be declining to affirm it?
You know, I don't. I'm not familiar with those arguments.
This was one of the definitive building blocks of the civil rights movement. I can't imagine that the backlash that a reconsideration of Brown, a serious reconsideration of Brown, would engender out there.
It would be a huge backlash. Nobody wants to go back to legally separated schools. That's a dead issue. I just don't. I'm not sure what the arguments might be. I know there were those that opposed desegregation at the time, but I find it I just find it unimaginable that it would be overturned, and the backlash would be huge. I suspect it would lead rapidly, if the court went that way, it would lead rapidly to a constitutional amendment that would probably be ratified rather quickly.
If some of our listeners can recall this ruling coming down and their reactions to it, we'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, you mentioned this already, but this really strikes me as so interesting. Nationwide, black students are now less likely to attend schools with whites than they were half a century ago. And that makes you wonder, was Brown, the ruling there, a failure?
I don't think it was a failure in the beginning, but it has been constrained somewhat by later rulings. For example, an inner city district like Detroit, which is overwhelmingly African-American and minority, was not allowed to reach out into the suburban schools for desegregation plans and to include those schools. And the court's reasoning was that the desegregation orders were to get rid of segregation by law, or de jure segregation. And those suburban schools had not been part of that. They had developed as white schools, but they weren't brought in to the actual de jure segregation. They had not imposed it. Therefore, the court said they can't be swept into a desegregation plan.
So that made solving the problem more difficult?
Much more difficult, because given white flight and other problems, even though those school districts did not segregate by law, they ended up largely white, and the inner cities then ended up largely minority. So transferring kids around the Detroit school district would have exactly no effect on the segregation there.
Huh. You know, in Kansas City, there's new data out that raises questions here. The Kansas City District has found its public and charter schools are increasingly racially segregated, expensive to operate, and losing high school students. The district released new analysis showing the city's school system is more segregated now than it was back in the 1990s. Again, not real promising here.
Not at all. This is a very thorny issue now. De jure segregation has been effectively eliminated in virtually every part of the country. So the desegregation orders have expired. And so now there's really not a constitutional reason to create affirmative action plans that would force students to leave their districts, because the basis of Brown has largely been taken care of.
But you could still argue, though, that we still have separate but equal systems, or at least in theory separate but equal systems.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any question. In fact, I'd say they're separate and unequal.
Yeah.
In many of those situations, the problem is that if you start reassigning students on the basis of race in order to maintain diverse student bodies, you violate the Equal Protection Clause the other way, because, again, you're making decisions based on race.
You know, give us a sense of how the court made this decision in Brown, and how did Earl Warren sort of work this to be what you describe as a unanimous decision?
Well, it's interesting. A year or so before, the case was up before the Supreme Court, and it was about to go 5-4 to uphold legal separate but equal.
Really?
And, yes. And the Chief Justice died. The case had been sent back for re-argument to examine the history of the Equal Protection Clause and whether education was even on their radar at the time, which it really wasn't. Public education was in its infancy then. So, but before the re-argument could take place, the Chief Justice died. Eisenhower promised Earl Warren the next opening on the court, and so he became Chief Justice. And I don't know all the inner workings of how he did it, but he was able to convince all of the members, even those who were going to vote to uphold separate but equal, to reject it in the field of public education. So it was a phenomenal feat, and interesting in one way, because in the Japanese internment during World War II, Earl Warren was one of its chief architects and proponents, and he came to regret that later in life, and I think he was already regretting it by the time he reached the Supreme Court.
That's interesting. So maybe he was trying to make up for bad decisions.
I think so. A couple of things had happened. One is that California schools had been desegregated with regard to Mexican Americans in 1947 under the California Constitution. While he was in California at that time, I think he was governor by then. So he had seen that, but I think he had felt that everything that happened to Japanese Americans during the war was not justified as he thought it was at the time, and I think he was. Yes, I think he had a profound shift in his thinking that followed him into the Supreme Court 10 years later.
So you're saying, Dan, that this country was on the brink of seeing its Supreme Court sign off on separate but equal when the Chief Justice passed away?
Yes. It would have been a 5-4 decision. So there was a split court, but it would have upheld Plessy versus Ferguson, which is where the separate but equal doctrine became constitutional.
And that's really extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Rachel tweeted this: though I wasn't directly impacted by Brown v. Board, I grew up in the Sumner Elementary School District and attended Sumner as a child. As a mixed-race person, I have deep appreciation for what the civil rights movement achieved. She goes on to ask, I'm interested in how long it took cities to actually desegregate. Are the laws that were on the books, redlining and such, still impacting the racial balance balance of schools and neighborhoods? It's a great question, Rachel.
Yes, I don't think there's any question that redlining is still having an impact, even though it's not legal. But heck, I remember personally in 1965, my parents moved into Leawood, and I remember seeing a Homes Association rules, and there was a line in there that no one who was Jewish or Black or Mexican, and there were several others, could purchase a home in Leawood. That's 1965, mm-hmm. 11 years after Brown, a year after the 64 Civil Rights Act. What makes this such a difficult problem is that sort of behavior by cities and states was so institutionalized that it forced pockets of racial isolation. And just because those things got struck down, the difficulty of moving from those pockets into other places was still resisted. That movement was still resisted for mm-hmm. a good long time.
Mm-hmm.
But it also set in place housing patterns and residential patterns
yeah.
that were not going to evaporate overnight just because legally it was possible to move. That didn't mean that factually that people could just up and move.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about two enormously consequential U.S. Supreme Court decisions, Brown v. Board and Roe v. Wade. We're wondering where you were when these decisions came down and your reactions to it. Let's move to the more recent case, Roe v. Wade, which obviously remains intensely controversial even today. Talk about the new Supreme Court, the more conservative court overturning Roe in perhaps the years to come. This case obviously affirmed the legality of a woman's right to have an abortion under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Daniel, where were you when that ruling came down, and did you recognize it for the consequential ruling that it was?
No, I was in high school in 1973. I was a senior.
Well, you're still a pup,
and
yeah.
I'm still just as young as I was. But I just wasn't even that aware of the whole situation,
right.
and
right.
I had no idea. I knew nothing about abortion really, and so it didn't mean a thing to me at the time.
Yeah. Let's get our listeners involved here. Where were you when the famous Roe decision came down? What reaction do you remember having or hearing about it when the ruling came down in 1973? Our number, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Dan, how did this ruling change the country? Because the impact on our politics, especially in this part of the country, remains incredibly profound, I think.
Well, the sad thing, I think, is that it became a political football in the nomination and my brain just stopped.
Of U.S. Supreme Court nominees over time, for sure.
Right, how justices get onto the court.
And, mm-hmm.
And so I think it did real damage to that whole process.
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate that it's still sitting out there that way, because we now have brand new abortion laws in three or four states now, Georgia, I think, being the most recent, Alabama probably sometime this week or
mm-hmm.
next, restricting abortion to around 6 weeks, which is when fetal heartbeat can typically be.
Missouri's looking at that idea too. Yeah,
and the problem with that, of course, is that most women don't even know they're pregnant until about 6 weeks, and so they're already jammed up as soon as they find out they're pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 816-235-2888. Where were you when the Roe versus Wade decision came down? What was your reaction to it? You can also tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. As you look back on it, Dan, was the ruling, the Roe ruling, a surprise?
Yeah, I think it was a surprise at the time. The real question is whether to have left the question with the states. And states were beginning to loosen up their abortion regulations at the time. The strict regulation of abortion was fairly recent vintage, really. It didn't begin until the latter half of the 19th century, mm-hmm. picked up steam in the first part of the 20th century. So it's not that we had a long history of regulating abortion.
Right.
Not in English common law, which we inherited, and not in American law until really close to the beginning of the 20th century.
Where were you when the Roe ruling came down in 1973? 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Ben from Leawood. Ben, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a retired physician, and I was very happy with the ruling because I had seen firsthand the results of women trying to abort themselves or someone else aborting them and getting infected and coming in with a high fever. This one lady had a temperature of 107.6. Fortunately, she survived, but some of them didn't.
Hmm. So you were relieved, Ben, because you knew that was going to become part of our past then at that point, that kind of backroom activity, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And then, you're...
That's what happened.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So, and that's what happened. The hospitals, certain hospitals, not all hospitals, certain hospitals set up systems so the abortion could be relatively inexpensive and easy to get.
Hmm.
And didn't have to be people coming in with temperatures 107.6.
Yeah. Ben, I'm glad you called. Thanks for that memory. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. No charge. Bye-bye.
You bet. Elizabeth from Lawrence. Elizabeth, you're on Up to Date as we talk about the impact of the Roe ruling back in 1973. Good morning.
Right. In 1964 to 1969, I was at the University of Texas, and there was a famous abortion case where a young man performed abortions on four sorority girls and they bled to death.
Mm.
And ever since then, I've been adamantly for legal abortion. I also knew people that would go to Mexico to get an abortion.
Mm. So that memory lingers with you pretty strongly, eh?
Of course. I mean, and it happens over and over. I mean, if it's not legal. And the thing is that bothers me is once the baby's born,
right,
some of the people that are against abortion aren't going to take care of the babies.
Elizabeth, thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Jane from Kansas City, Missouri. Jane, you're on Up to Date.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I was very happy when Roe versus Wade went into law. I had had an illegal abortion the year before in Kansas City, Kansas. It was horrible. Took place in an abandoned school building.
Hmm.
It was very expensive. And I don't want to see anyone have to go through that, what I went through. It was horrible.
How scary was it, Jane?
It was terribly scary. I woke up all alone. I was hemorrhaging, and the so-called doctor and nurse that performed the illegal abortion were gone. The lights were out, and the building was abandoned.
Jane, I almost can't fathom that.
Well, I went to Catholic school.
I know from working in the 90s as a volunteer in the abortion clinic in St. Louis, Missouri, to assist women in getting into the clinic. I know that the majority of women who have abortions are Catholic because, like I, who went to Catholic school for 12 years,
mm-hmm.
the Catholic Church does not condone birth control.
Right.
I'm getting a little bit off the subject, but several girls that I went to high school with in the late 60s and early 70s died from illegal abortions.
Yeah.
Of course, it was covered up, and people said they died of other causes.
Yeah. Jane, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You know, I'm wondering, Dan, Justice Harry Blackmun wrote this ruling famously. What do we know about how the court came to its decision?
Well, I can tell you what the decision said, and that is that, you know, what a lot of people I don't think understand is that the Roe decision is not based on a conflict between the rights of the unborn and the rights of the mother. The court basically said that there was no 14th Amendment right to life attaching to the unborn. And therefore, the real conflict was the state's interest in protecting that life versus the mother's fundamental right to control her own reproductive autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, control her own body and make her own decisions about childbearing.
Who had the controlling authority there, the mother or the state?
Well, that was the real question. And what Roe and later Casey clarified is that because it's a fundamental right, the state had to have a compelling reason to interrupt her right, to interfere with her right. And a compelling reason is a reason of the highest order.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very strict test. And the court concluded ultimately that at viability, the state's interest had become sufficiently compelling that it could then interfere with the woman's fundamental right. So the real fight is, what is the state's interest, and when in the pregnancy does its interest become compelling? The interest exists from the earliest stages of the pregnancy, but it doesn't become compelling until viability, and that's where we are today.
That's where we are today, right.
These new laws are trying to shove that interest back as far as possible.
Mm-hmm.
They're clearly unconstitutional. They'll be struck down at every level. And so they'll be appealed up into the Supreme Court. And if the court decides to take it, that's when it's going to get interesting.
Yeah. That's Dan Weddle with the UMKC Law School, serves as Director of Academic Support. Thanks so much for your time and your expertise today, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here.
Tomorrow on the show, the Missouri legislature will soon adjourn, and the conservative caucus has been throwing its weight around the state house. We'll find out what effect they've had tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.